The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Koan Collection, Case 12. Dzong, planting the fields. The pointer. Scholars plow with the pen. Orators plow with the tongue. We seekers of the way lazily watch a white ox on open ground, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. How to pass the days? The main case. Dzong asked Zhurshan, "Where do you come from?" Zhurshan said, "From the south." Dzong said, "How is Buddhism in the South these days?" Zhurshan said, "There's extensive discussion." Dzong said, "How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" Zhurshan said, "What can you do about the world?" Dzong said, "What do you call the world?" Hongzhi's poem. Source and explanation. Planting fields, making rice, ordinary household matters. Only those who have investigated to the full would know. Having investigated to the full, you clearly know there's nothing to seek. Zhifang, after all, didn't care to be enfeoffed as a marquis. Forgetting his state, he returned, same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Kanglong, the hazy waters of autumn. So, good morning. Great compassion, we chant, this very moment is mine. This very moment is no other than mine. And then we recognize that our actions are wondrous in their simplicity. So all weekend in this introductory retreat, we've been studying various aspects of traditional Buddhist teachings and practice, specifically as it comes down in the Zen tradition and in our own training here in this lineage. The koans, did you mention koans yesterday? The koans are a traditional part of some Zen schools, koan inquiry, the taking up of an essential question in one's meditation with a challenge. As you bring in those words and the meaning within them, do not think about them. Do not contemplate. Do not ruminate. That very familiar way we have of working with words, that relationship with language, we are trying to release, liberate, and find a whole new way of working with, in essence, phenomena. In the Mahayana, the importance of realizing the true nature of self and all phenomena, because we live in a world with lots of it, right? And that's where the tangles occur. The phenomena within us and everywhere that we call outside. And so the koans bring a really key element of that of the world, language, meaning, directly into the meditation. Normally we think of meditation as a place where you are not engaging in language, letting go of the narrative. And so it is. But the koans are, in a sense, a very dangerous spiritual practice because we can just get tangled the way we always do, or not. And in not, discovering a whole different way of relating to teachings, to language, but phenomena. A special transmission outside the scriptures with no reliance on words and letters, Bodhidharma is said to have described or characterized as Zen tradition, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of enlightenment. And so there he's making the point that although we use sutras necessarily, thank goodness we have these teachings, otherwise we wouldn't be here. But they only take us so far. They can only, in a sense, serve up to a point, and then we have to let them go and enter into a place where there is no words, no language, no meaning. That's the direct pointing. So how do we point directly to mind? Right in the poem it says, source and explanation variously are all made up. The Buddha said all the world and everything we can see and perceive is mind. We only know the world because we experience it in our mind. Well, what if our mind is cloudy? What if it sees things in a way that's distorted? And that distortion has become so integrated that it doesn't appear as distortion, it appears as clarity. What if we have false views that we are basing actions and thoughts and our life on, but those false views have been so integrated within us, we have so much faith in them that we don't see them as false? Then what? Well, look around and we see the evidence of that. And so scholars plow with the pen, orators with the tongue, but what do practitioners of the way, how do we plow the field? We can't discard words and ideas, otherwise there's no teaching, there's no way to convey the teaching, which is not true, because it's conveyed all the time without words. But we don't need to discard, because the problem is not in the words, it's not in the meaning of the words. So we can't discard them, but at the same time we can't fully rely upon them, because otherwise the teachings become objectified, solidified, made into something that they're not. And so in this koan, Dzogchen, who's a teacher of Dzogchen, and this is 9th century China, asks him where he comes from. So this is a meeting. And Dzogchen says, from the south. And Dzogchen says, how's it going in the south these days? What's up with the Buddha Dharma down there? And Dzogchen says, there's a whole lot of discussion going on. Then, now, probably always, it's an easy place to get stuck. Talking about things brings pleasure. It can be a way of sharing time together, learning, for sure. But when it becomes extensive, it ceases to serve its purpose in terms of how it can really help us. It becomes a thing in and of itself. It becomes actually a distraction. It can become everything we know about Buddhism and practice while we're not practicing. It's one of the aspects of face-to-face teaching, why all students are asked to not discuss what goes on in those meetings with the teacher, partly because it becomes something else. It passing from ear to mouth, it comes apart. Right? When we speak of it, it starts to come apart in our mind, it becomes something else. Now we're talking about something. It's no longer the thing itself. And we're communicating that with somebody else, so it's coming apart even further. So how do we plow? We plow with the mind, with the body, the whole body and mind. We plow free of body and mind. We learn to plow with the whole earth, with trees and shit sticks and front gates and whatever seems to be at hand. Let your whole self be the plow and the field and the seed and the sun and the rain. There's a story about how Dzogchen came to Dzogchen. Dzogchen was traveling on a pilgrimage with some of his practitioner friends. Fayan was one of them. And they got stopped by a heavy storm. And so they sequestered themselves at Dzogchen's temple. And they were sitting around the fire one night because it was cold, talking to themselves, ignoring Dzogchen, who is the abbot, the master, which is rude. But they were having their conversation and Dzogchen was listening. And then he sort of slid forward and says, there's something I'd like to ask you elders about. Do you mind? And they said, no, if there's something you want to know, just ask. And Dijang said, are the mountains, rivers, and earth identical or separate from all of you elders? And Zhejiang said, separate. And Dijang held up two fingers. And Zhejiang said, identical, identical. And Dijang held up two fingers. And then he just walked away. And Fayan, his Dharma brother, says, what was the meaning of his holding up two fingers like that? And Zhejiang said, oh, he just did that arbitrarily. Doesn't mean anything. And Fayan said, don't crudely insult him. And Zhejiang said, can you find elephant tusks in a rat's mouth? In other words, can you find something of great value in the mouth of a rat? So the next day when they were leaving, so what's illustrative of that is you just see a little bit about where their minds were at. But then the next day they were leaving. And as they were leaving, Fayan said, you go ahead. I'm going to stay behind with Dijang for a while. He may have something to offer. So you just imagine that all night he'd been reflecting on this. What did he mean? What was he saying? And the fact that he just got up and walked away made it even more pressing. And so Fayan said, you guys go ahead. I'm going to stay behind. So they did. But eventually they too came back and studied with Dijang and became his disciples. Are we separate from the mountains and rivers, or are we identical from the earth and the cities and the machines and the bridges? Are we separate or the same? Are those questions actually taking us in or creating confusion? How is Buddhism in the South these days? Extensive discussion. So in our time, we have Buddhist journals and books and podcasts and YouTubes and talks that are put online like this one. I mean, in the early years when I first began practicing, it was a big challenge because it was very hard to get information on Buddhism. You go to the encyclopedia, like how heartwarming is that? Right? And now it's almost the opposite situation. There's so much out there. Extensive discussion. And the more something goes out, the more it has to sort of assume a level playing field. Right? The more it's trying to reach more and more, the more it has to sort of the peaks and valleys, the sharp challenges, the subtleties, those have to get worked out. Right? They get lost. They don't appeal on that level of extensive discussion. And so more people are hearing about it, more people are finding out, more people are learning, more people are having discussions. But the thing that's being discussed, what's happening to that? And so as practitioners, it's actually a very important thing for people who are serious about practice is to be self-aware of how we're using all that is available to us that presents itself as Buddha Dharma so that it actually doesn't become a distraction and to be able to recognize when that's what's happening. Its point has always been to bring us closer in, to bring us back into our meditation, to cultivate right understanding so we know how to meditate, that we understand what the teachings are speaking to when they use words like samadhi or prajna or detachment or enlightenment or emptiness. So Zhejiang says there's extensive discussion, and Dijang says, how can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat? And the footnote to that line says, don't brag so much. You know, what's so interesting about these koans is when the self is still very much in place, then it sees everything and hears everything through the self. And it sees and hears everything in relationship to itself in terms of, is this something I want or don't want? is something that affirms or does not affirm. Do I move towards it or do I move away? That's self-centeredness is a perfect frame. A word, it's centering everything in terms of this sense of self, self-referential. But when the self has been seen through, then we see that there are words that seem to be about the self, but they're not. They seem to be recreating and perpetuating samsara, but they're actually trying to free us of it. They're using words, the same words with the same meaning, but the basis, the reference system, is no longer the self. So now how is it? So when Dzogchen says, how can that compare to me here planting the fields? It seems obvious that he's saying what I'm doing is better. Because that's our ordinary way of looking at things. And then when the commentary, the footnote says, don't brag so much, it sounds like, yeah, don't brag so much. Don't set yourself up as higher. And so the job of the work of the practitioner is to see into it and see the mind of the teacher who uttered those words, which means your mind and the mind of the teacher have to merge. You have to, in other words, see it in the same way, be standing on the same ground, which means we have to let go of the ground that we've been holding on to. So how do we study the ultimate nature of the self and other? Given that that which we're seeking, I spoke about this a little bit on Friday night, is not in an object, it's not a sound, it's not a taste, it's not something you can eat or touch, put your hands on, but a nature is not an object. It's not something that diminishes or augments. It's not in the past or the future or the present. It's not inside or outside. You can't gain it and you can't lose it. Nothing virtuous you do is going to bring it closer. Nothing unvirtuous you do is going to make it farther away. How do we study that? Right? We can imagine the Buddha, after his enlightenment, reflecting on that, thinking, I don't think this is going to work. Particularly because, as he said, as he surveyed the landscape, people are just too enamored of their attachments, of their point of view. They won't be able to hear this unless they release their grasp a little bit. The very idea that there's something we need that is outside of us is creating the very mind that we're trying to free ourselves from. That's why it's so precarious to try and practice exclusively on our own. You know, when I came, by the time I came here for the first time, I've been practicing for about a decade on my own, almost exclusively on my own, with very little reading, because there wasn't a lot to read. And I had the sense that I had reached the end of my capacity to guide myself. And I didn't know particularly why I thought that or what that meant or what I was doing or could be doing differently. I just had a sense that I was at the end of my, that I was at my limit. And I was right. It's hard for the self that is trying to free itself of itself to guide itself when that self is all it knows and what it trusts and has depended upon, and thinks is the sole reason we've gotten this far. And so there's a phrase in Zen, Eko Hensho, which means to turn the light around. To turn the light around. One master said, I follow the stream to its source, and then sit and see where the clouds rise. We could give beginning instruction with just those words. Sit, follow the stream back to its source, and see where the clouds rise. Now, find your seat. Because in essence, that's what's being taught. Another master said, when you get here, turn the light around to shine back. Shine it back. Right? Our lives, so much is going out, 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 out. That's where all the action is. That's where the problems are. That's where the things that need to be attended to are. And they are demanding. Those things are demanding. If we don't take care of them, things start to fall apart, right? And what is much harder to see is that when we don't turn the line back, light around, and shine it back, we see, oh, things have been falling apart. The house is in a fair state of disarray. That's what I've been experiencing. That's why I am seeking something. That's why, although everything may be reasonably okay, it's not okay. We think of our time as a kind of spiritual sickness, with that energy going out, 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 seeking something, and finding, there's so much to find. There's so many things to find. And that if we don't take refuge in something that actually has some truth to it, that has some honesty to it, that is good in and of itself, we will find refuge in something else. And so we shine the light back and see the clouds rise. We see the grip getting tighter. We see not accepting. We see fear. We see annoyance. We see a whole host. Buddhism, early Buddhism, basically inventoried all of those aspects of the house in disarray so we could examine them. And what do? We sit and we face them, and a revolution begins. Don't turn away. Don't subdue it. Don't dominate it. Don't deny it. That hasn't worked so far. It's not going to work in the future. Don't get entangled in it. Don't tell another story. That hasn't worked in the past. It's not going to work in the future. And what that means, in short, is that we have to learn how to be uncomfortable and find comfort in that. Not in the sense of seeking that, but in the sense of being able to be patient and tolerate and forbear that discomfort. You know, I wonder how much of the madness, the pain, the violence that is put out, is turned outward, is an expression of not being able to tolerate any longer the same violence, the aggression, the hatred, the absence within. And so that house in disarray that is on fire becomes you. And so we chant, Kanze Onet, one with the Buddha, the great compassionate one, one with the Buddha, related to every Buddha in cause and effect. Joyful, pure, eternal being. You can't create it. You can't kill it. You can't gain it. You can't lose it. Where is it? Morning mind, evening mind, this very moment. That's where it is. How do we turn our attention to that? That's what we've been talking about all weekend. We call it practice. We call it zazen. We call it liturgy. We call it kenin. We call it mindfulness. And in that, we recognize that our activities are wondrous in their simplicity. We don't need to add and adorn and ornament. When we are bored, it's because we are not here. We are not in a moment of simplicity. We are not in contact with what is here and now. Wondrous in their simplicity means plain like water. You know, we can think, oh, I don't want water. I want something that has flavor, that has taste, that has interest, that will do something more for me. And all that's fine, but water is a miracle. And it's a miracle because it's plain. And in that plainness, not so plain. Lucid, without pretension, without contrivance, things as they are. a well-worn phrase in Buddhism, and therefore a kind of dangerous phrase. Oh yeah, just let things be as they are. I got it. Not quite. And so we study how passionately we don't let things be as they are. Students get to a point in their zazen often where there's nothing active in their mind, but there's clearly something that seems to be in the way from things as they are. Yes. There's a story where Fayan and Xershan, who were Dharma brothers, were traveling. And Xershan said, the ancients, the Buddhas of the past, said that the single body, your fundamental reality body, your true nature, is revealed in the 10,000 forms, is present in every single thing in the universe. Did those ancient Buddhas have to dispel the 10,000 things? Did they have to let them go? Did they have to get rid of them to realize that that ultimate self, that ultimate nature, or not? And Xershan said, they didn't dispel them. And Fayan said, why do you say dispel or don't dispel? And Xershan was confused, and so he went back to Dijang and said, and Dijang said, you haven't been gone long. Why'd you come back? And Xershan said, there's an unresolved matter, so I don't want to go traveling until it's resolved. And Dijang said, it's not bad that you travel to difficult places. But Xershan didn't understand, and so he said, the single body is revealed in the 10,000 forms. What does this mean? And Dijang said, do you say the ancients dispelled the 10,000 forms or not? Do you say that you have to get rid of those forms? And Xershan said, they didn't dispel them. And Dijang said, and for a time, Xershan was lost in thought, and then he said, I don't know whether the ancients dispelled the 10,000 things or not. And Dijang said, what is it you call the 10,000 things? And at that, Xershan had an insight. How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat? And Xershan said, what can you do about the world? Dijang said, what do you call the world? What is this world that you speak of? Bill Waldron, a scholar and practitioner, said, what we experience in our world, or our worlds, are better seen as constructs arising out of the interaction of our sense faculties and the phenomena that impinge upon them, all the things that come in through our eyes and ears and nose. So it's a construct that arises out of this interaction. We're interacting. And he says, those objects we experience are thus neither representations of what is truly out there, but nor are they pure fabrications based on our subjective dispositions alone. They're not entirely out there. They're not entirely in here. They are dependently arisen. However, these constructive processes occur unconsciously and are therefore difficult for ordinary beings to observe. Source and explanations variously are all made up. And that's really the heart of Buddhist practice. Buddhist teachings on dependent origination, which is where he really expounds on this intimate interconnection between senses and objects and what we do with that in our mind, is, I think, arguably one of the most important teachings that the Buddha offered. And it's difficult. There's a sutra where Ananda says to the Buddha, that is such a wonderful teaching, and it's so clear. And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, it is not clear at all. Effectively, if you practice for many more years, it will just begin to become more clear. There's another encounter where another master, Luahan, saw a student approaching and held up a whisk and said, do you understand? And the student says, thank you for your compassionate teaching, master. And Luohan said, "You see me raise the whisk and you say I'm instructing you. When you see mountains and rivers each day, do they not instruct you?" Another time, another student came and Luohan held up the whisk. And the monk shouted in praise and bowed. And Luohan said, "When you see me raise the whisk, you bow and shout. Why is it that when someone holds up a broom, you don't shout and bow?" If we want to see the mind, we can turn inward and trace it back. If we want to see the mind, we can look outward and trace it back. When you see someone or something in front of you, as a practice, just notice, what is your immediate sense of that thing, of that person? Do you like them? Do you not like them? Are they trustworthy or not? How smart are they? And see how quickly we can assemble a full portfolio, right? Having never met, having still not met this person. Isn't that basis of all acts of aggression and violence? We do that even with people we love. We're in that moment of hurting them. We are not seeing them. What we're seeing is our own mind. And so when we calm ourselves, quiet our senses, and look right into the source and let it be shining bright and clear. Initially, it's not so easy to do that. There seems to be much in the way. And so again, we have to work with that, those obstructions, that what seems to be the mountains in front of the mountain. And so it can be valuable to see something like this, or an altar. Because if I hold up a broom, right? So what? So we hold up something that seems to have some particular special value to get our attention, to begin an inquiry, to begin wondering. But at some point, if that process is real, if it's actually unfolding, then there will be a point at which we realize, oh, wait a minute, it's not about this object. It's not exclusive. When we reflect on what we see within ourselves, within the world, greed, anger, delusion, hatred, fear, intolerance, impatience, we see how attachments to a sense of self, what we're seeing, is how attachments to a sense of self express themselves. How attachment to desire, how attachment to identities, how attachment to status, to power, to wealth, to life itself, to an idea. And that's why Buddhism says to attach to anything, even the Dharma, even a teaching, even a Buddha image. The phrase is, even gold dust, if it gets into your eyes, is going to blind you. Even something that has a great capacity to help you, if we don't hold it well in our minds, it will start to become poisonous. And I've always appreciated that about Buddhism, that it cautions us about itself. And the caution isn't about it. The danger isn't in the image. It's in our mind. But that means as practitioners, we have to be very alert to how we are, if we're practicing Buddhism, how we're engaging in all of Buddhism to keep it upright. And when we look and see all of those sort of activities of pain and suffering, what we're seeing is attachment. But at the same time, if we look around and see in any moment, no matter how small, no matter how simple or how large, there's something that is affirming and positive and helpful and healing, that's because to some measure there is non-attachment. There is not self-centeredness. There is letting go. There is putting others first. That's what we're seeing. And those two perspectives are not accidents. They're direct causes. And so then the question is, what is the state of this inner world? What is the state of this house? becomes all important, right? If you don't take care of your home, right, dust starts to collect, it starts to fall apart. Bulbs burn out and you're in the dark, right? Don't pay your rent, you get evicted. But what happens when we don't take care of this house? What are the interactions of our faculties and the phenomena that depend upon them? What is it that we call the world? And so the poem says, only those who have investigated to the full will know. And so that's how we plow the field. We investigate. And we have to learn how to investigate, because normally we would just do that conceptually. How do we use this mind, this bright, clear, lucid, sharp, awake, miraculously aware mind? Well, we have to bring it out of its dullness, bring it out of its sleepiness, bring it out of its lethargy and its apathy, all of which are very sort of good strategies to live in a world that's kind of hard to live in, right? Just shut it down. It makes sense. Right, just lower the curtain, put up the wall, close the door. It seems to be quieter. But it's not really a life yet. And so in opening the curtain, opening the door, turning that bright, clear light, now we have to learn how to meet pain and sorrow, inside and outside. And that becomes an indispensable skill along the way. And it's not just tolerating and enduring it because it's forever and nothing is going to change, but because in that, doors open in our capacity to experience it as it is, not as we think it is. What is it that you call pain and sorrow? What is it that I call anger and fear? What is it that I call the mountain that I'm trying to get away from? That's what Dzogchen is asking. What do you call the world is a call to come in. Master Dogen said, to study the way is to study oneself. When you study oneself, ultimately you forget that self. You free yourself of that attachment, of that self-centering. We realize that's a construct and it's not necessary. And in forgetting the self and letting go of that self-centering, we become enlightened to phenomena, to the mountains and rivers, to the world. And to be enlightened to the world is to be freed of your body and mind and the mind and bodies of others. We realize, in a way, it makes the pain greater. You know, if everything we create, all the madness and violence and so on, was sort of necessary in some way, you know, because that's just what we are, then we'd be like, well, just, you know, good night and good luck, do the best you can. But the fact that that's not who we are, it's not necessary. It's not our nature, and that liberating ourselves from that is imminently available to us, because it is never anywhere else. Then it makes our pain and sorrow less and less necessary, which means easier and easier to free ourselves of. We don't need it anymore. We don't need it anymore. In a sense, we have needed it in curious ways, but no longer. But as we go out into the world to try and do something good, it's not all so clear. And so even though we see every sentient being's body and mind is already free, when we don't know that, then we act out of what we do know. Only those who have investigated to the full will know. Investigating to the full, now you know there's nothing to seek. All along, it's you. There's a story of an old master who went into the toilet one night. And in going in there, he bumped into a monk in the dark that was coming out of the toilet. And the master grabbed him and said, "Thief, thief, I've got him." And the monk said, "Master, no, it's not me." And the master says, "It is. You just won't own up to it." And maybe that's what we're doing in practice, owning up to it. It's me. All along. And when we own up to it, it's not a burden. Far from it. It's a source of joy and compassion. And so Zhifang was a minister of an emperor, and the emperor wanted to reward him for all the good service that he'd done and wanted to give him all of these cities that he would be in charge of. And he said, "I don't want any of that. I don't want to be enfiefed as a marquis. I don't need that. That's not what I'm seeking." Forgetting his state, he returned, just like fish and birds, traveling lazily along, washing feet in the Kanglang and the Asopus River, the hazy waters of autumn, of spring. This great compassionate heart is at one with Buddha wisdom, with your mind. And it's related to every Buddha. You are in relationship with every enlightened being, all the way back to the Buddha. An intimate relationship, more intimate than you know. And that because of cause and effect, you are here, we are here, and we have the opportunity. Joyful, pure, eternal being, morning mind is Kanzeon, evening mind is Kanzeon. This very moment arises from nothing else but mind. It is never apart from mind. That's your inheritance. That's your great gift that at the same time is nothing special. Everyone has it. But can we use it? And so particularly for those of you who have joined us for the weekend, I want to encourage you. It was very nice having you all here. It's wonderful to have folks come in who are really seeking and curious and sincere and engaged in the practice. It's why we're here. And I just want to encourage you that whatever this weekend was for you, whatever it clarified or whatever direction it might have pointed you towards, strengthened, or to just keep tending to it. The Buddha said, if everyone understood how important generosity is, as I would, he said, you would never take a bite of food without offering it to somebody else. That's what we do in our meal gatha. And I think in the same way, if we fully understood our true nature, who we actually are, what this life actually is, then we would not be so easily tempted. We would not turn away. We would not forsake practice. We would find a way. You know, we're pretty good at that when something is really important to us, really important. We generally can find a way. And my wish is that we bring life to that sense of urgency. My teacher called it a spiritual imperative. Because it's not just your life that's at stake here. In a sense, we are depending on you. Right? Because you're a part of this. And whatever you've got, you're bringing that to us. That's my responsibility to you. Right? If we could all own up to that together, ooh, that'd be good. So we start where we are with one or two or a few.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.